So we're continuing in the book or through the book of Ecclesiastes, and I am not even trying to go verse by verse. They are so deep, and that would be about an hour and a half, 2 hour sermon if I tried just to tackle chapter 7 verse by verse. But I've picked out what I thought were some of the verses that were most profound, most impactful. But let me also start with a brief little explanation on how you can dig into whether Ecclesiastes or the Proverbs, because so many times they are just these pressure-packed, amazing, golden nuggets of truth that need to be delved into to be able to unpack the richness of the meaning. And so think of it this way. When you're reading through a proverb, I mean, there's other scripture texts and other books in the Bible where you can kind of just read it through, and it reads more through like a story, especially like if we're going through the gospel, a gospel, you can just read some of the stories of Jesus doing a miracle or Jesus teaching. But especially with the Proverbs, I find you have to let that verse wash over your mind again and again. So think, if you've ever been on a beach and you've ever watched the waves wash up on the shore and then wash up on the shore and wash up on the shore, when we're working with a proverb, let it wash over your mind and then wash over your mind and then wash over your mind, and then think about it from different angles, different aspects. So a good proverb is kind of like a prism. A prism, think about like a diamond or some beautiful jewel. You know, it has many different facets, many faces, and a different angle can give you a different look. And so sometimes as that proverb is washing over your mind, you're thinking about it in the context of my life, my heart, in the context of my marriage, in the context of my parenting, in the context when I'm at work. See how you're allowing it to wash over, but looking at it, examining it from different contexts. That's how we can treat a proverb with integrity. Because otherwise, if you just kind of speed read through the Proverbs and superficially look them over, at best, you're going to get very little out of it. At worst, you're going to flat out misunderstand it and take it the wrong way. But if you can really examine it, these are gold nuggets, and they are precious, and they really work in the heart. So let me give you some examples. We'll just go through, starting with verse 1 in chapter 7. In the first part of the verse, it says, a good name is better than fine perfume. So let's talk a little bit about the value of a name. So I want you to get out of your mind that there's any arrogance or pomposity attached to that. Now, some people can be that way with their name, but think of how God feels about a good name. How about his own? And how jealous he is about his own name. So that, what is his command about his name? Thou shalt not misuse the name of the Lord. Oh, he's jealous about that name, his name, because his name identifies with his character. And when we just sloppily, with indignity, besmirch, blemish his name, ah, God, Jesus Christ, are you kidding? You're taking that precious name of God and using it as a cuss word to be just intermingled or changed out for some cuss word? No. And think, see how jealous God is about his name. And how about his son? It says in Philippians that Jesus was given the name above all names, and that at that name every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus is Lord. He was given the name above all names. So that's God's attitude toward a name, right? And so it's healthy, it's appropriate that we would want a good name, because our name identifies with our character. And so how do you establish a good name? I love Paul gives us some advice. No, I'm sorry. This is from Proverbs. Proverbs 3:3-4. It says, let love and faithfulness never leave you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart. In other words, I mean, get love and faithfulness in you. Let it stick with you. And it's, let it be identified with your very character. You are loving. You are faithful. Then you will win favor and a good name in the sight of God and man. So establish yourself in love and faithfulness. And that's one of the best ways of developing and establishing a good name. So, but now what happens if a name is sullied, darkened, blackened? How does that happen? What sullies a name? Well, it can be something done against us. Gossip, slander, accusations, besmirch, sully, blacken a person's name and character. And that's why God is also very angry about gossip, very angry about slander. And as Christians, we should not engage in it because it's character assassination. It assassinates their name. It's wrong, right? So that's these attacks from the outside, but I myself can sully my own name. How do I do that? Consequences of my bad decisions. Consequences of sin. A young girl decides she's gonna sleep with guys. How does that sully her name? How does that sully her character? There's all kinds of ways that we can sully a name. You choose to drink and drive, and then you get into an accident. And then it might not just be your character, but it goes on your very record. And so you get convicted because you injured somebody. In fact, in the news I've been seeing that this is really a big deal in politics right now. There's a lot of people who've been to jail. Their name has a black mark on it. They've got a conviction. They committed a felony. And of course, in a lot of jobs, they do a lot of background searches now. Even here in church, by law, we're required that anybody's going to work with children, we have to do a background check, right? I had somebody last week in my office needing some financial help. And I was just asking, you know, some details. One of the things she mentioned is she has a CNA, Certified Nursing Associate for Certificate, but she can't work in that field. She didn't describe to me what it was, but she said, I have a felony years back, but I'll never be able to work in that field again. Her character, her name, has that black mark. So then what do you do? I mean, what do you do if your name has been sullied, if there is a black mark? Well, this is the beauty of the gospel. The beauty of the gospel is our very character can be transformed so that even a murderer, I mean, could you imagine a pastor, somebody who physically murdered somebody? Can he be a pastor? Well, that was Moses, wasn't it? Well, what about somebody who committed adultery? Now, could that person ever again preach the word of God? Well, that was King David, right? And many of his psalms, best psalms, he wrote after the adultery with Bathsheba. Here's the transforming nature of the gospel, and I love it. 1 Corinthians 6:11 says, and Paul's talking, and he's just talked about he went through a list of some pretty heinous sins, and then he says, and that is what some of you were. Because of those sins, you were this and that. It was your character. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ. So now you've taken on his name, his very character. You've been clothed with Christ. And by the Spirit of our God, the Spirit at work did a transformation. Here's the good news. If anyone is in Christ Jesus, the old has gone, the new has come. 2 Corinthians 5:17. So if you have sullied your character as a black mark, this is the core essence of the good news. Our whole character can be transformed and changed. That's what we need to do, is allow Christ to wash, sanctify, justify us. All right, continuing on, with verse 1, the second part. Now, here's where King Solomon, the wise cynic, starts to turn our understanding on its head. I mean, is this normally the way you think? And the day of death is better than the day of birth? Excuse me? Verse 2, it's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. For death is the destiny of every man. So, yeah, Nick, maybe tonight you and Lacey will be thinking, well, there's this party that, yeah, that'd be kind of fun to go to. Nah, let's go to the funeral home instead. Is that the way we think? This is kind of odd, isn't it? He says the living should take this to heart. Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter. Really? Really? Because a sad face is good for the heart. Serious? Verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning. It's like the house of the funeral home. But the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. All right. Lucy, you got some splaining to do. Okay. So, the value of mourning. Let's talk about the value of mourning. You know, especially after the tragic incident this last week in Florida. I mean, should we just, well, go on with life? Go on with the same old, same old? Wouldn't it be appropriate to mourn? Wouldn't it be appropriate to think, what is going on here? What is so tragically wrong with our society today that our children are taking arms into school and shooting others? The wise will consider the fools. Just go back to the house of pleasure. Go back with the same old, same old. Just focus on the fun. Focus on the party. The wise person will consider. Grief is something that we all will go through. And it's something that we need to do well. Because if we don't do sorrow well, if we don't consider the times of mourning, if we aren't appropriately processing that grief, that would be very unwise. Because grief tends to knock us off course, doesn't it? So it's very appropriate and very wise to give good consideration. Far too often we want to ignore it. We want to run from it. It doesn't feel good, and I agree it doesn't, but the wise will boldly and with courage square their shoulders and talk about it, even dwell on it, not unnecessarily and not excessively, but process it well. Because grief happens to all of us. So that's the one angle, sorrow versus joy. But point B, the other thing is, it's our hope in death, not our hope for death. It's not like this death wish we have. It's our hope in death. And the Apostle Paul talked about this a lot. He says it this way. He says, for while we are in this tent, we groan and we're burdened because we do not wish to be unclothed, but to be clothed instead with our heavenly dwelling so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life, by real life. So it's not a death wish he had. It's a wish for glory. It's a wish for this, to be rid of this sinful, foolish body that struggles. And, how I would love to be clothed with my heavenly body, is what he's saying. That's very appropriate. He could go on to say, for to me, to live is Christ, to die is gain. So you have this healthy attitude of death. So, death and wisdom go hand in hand. Verse 5, he says, it's better to heed a wise man's rebuke than to listen to the song of fools. And the NLT version says, it's better to heed a wise man's rebuke than to listen to the praise of fools. Yeah, let's talk about rebuke. The value of a good rebuke. Is that the way we think? Is that the way? I love it when somebody rebukes me, when somebody tells me I'm doing something stupid and warns me. I just love it when somebody confronts me. You know what? That's the way the wise man thinks. Really, listen to some of the proverbs that King Solomon had. He says, "He who listens to the rebuke of life will abide among the wise." If you are open to a rebuke, if you are open to somebody telling you what you're doing is wrong and self-destructive, and then you will dwell with the wise. In fact, here's the way King David said it, Psalm 141:5. "Let a righteous man strike me." Really? That is a kindness. "Let him rebuke me. That is oil on my head. My head will not refuse it." I've said to buddies before, all right, here's an accountability. I mean, you know, Christians, a couple guys in fellowship and everything. Listen, can we be accountability partners? So if you see me doing something stupid, I'm open wide. Just slug me, will you? I mean, serious. If you ever saw me over here, as Parrish thought I'd ever, flirting with some cute girl, I'd want you to grab a hold of me, pull me aside, and just knock me to the ground. Do it. And you tell me, that is so disgraceful towards your wife and towards your God. Rebuke me, please. If I were to ever do something stupid, just giving you some fanciful, but even if it wasn't so fanciful. So women, what if? How open would you be if a good friend of yours, a Christian friend, all of a sudden just stopped you and said, "Excuse me, that's gossip, and I don't want to have anything to do with it"? Would you be open to that? A wise person would. Please, please. So, in other words, hey, if you saw a kid, 6, 7 years old, playing with a live grenade, what would you do? If you were a loving, normal person, would you rebuke the kid? "What are you doing? Get that out of your hands on my gosh!" Things that's messed up about our society today, we so much don't like rebukes. We want to affirm the children. We want to affirm them. Oh, well, you might consider it a grenade. I just consider it, what's the little thing, the little box? Huh? No, what's the thing instead of the spinning thing? Not the spinner. Fidget cube. You might consider it a live grenade. His reality is a fidget cube. And so who are you to tell him that he's wrong? Really? Little kid's fidget. It's a fidget cube. Gee, what's that? Pin? Please, please, make a promise to yourself. Be open to life-giving rebukes. What do you mean? What's the difference? He who listens to a life-giving rebuke will abide among the wise. So it needs to be a life-giving rebuke. There's a difference between criticism, which is just harsh and tears you down, right? But a rebuke, if it comes from love, and if you want to know, is that a righteous rebuke? Is it a life-giving rebuke? Compare it to the Bible. If the woman told you, "That's gossip, and I don't want to have anything to do with it," go back. What does the Bible say? Yeah, the Bible tells me gossip's wrong. That was a life-giving rebuke, and I need to heed it. I need to welcome it. Better is open rebuke than hidden love. Wounds from a friend can be trusted, but an enemy multiplies kisses. Oh, you're doing just great. Oh, you're just great. No, bam. That wound from a friend can be trusted. Good friends rebuke. So keep yourself open to rebuke and consider the possibility and when you might need to give somebody a rebuke in love and grace. All right, verses 8 to 9 and 21 to 22, they talk to me about the value of patience. And this is what I was trying to explain to the kids, but He says the end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride, because oftentimes it's pride in us that is really at work when we're being impatient. I mean, really, when you're driving your car and that person is, they're only doing the speed limit, come on! Seriously? Who's with me? I mean, is it only me that struggles with it? Yeah, it's usually pride at work, isn't it? Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. So it's not just the kids that need to think big. Breathe. In. Stay in. Don't go out. Don't leave the room. Stay in. Stay connected. Hey, this is golden advice for spouses and marriage and parents with kids. And so stay in. Stay in there. Give them grace. Do they deserve it? No. But neither do you. But God gave you grace, right? The value of patience. Because when we demonstrate patience, and it is the fruit of the Spirit, only by God's help can we have a phenomenal opportunity to demonstrate God's grace and to witness to others of His amazing grace. Yeah, the value of patience is huge. And then point six, the value of good perspective. Verse 10 says, well, do not say, why were the old days better than these? Oh, I find myself guilty of this all the time. Can we admit it, teenagers? I'm always having coffee with the teenagers on Thursday mornings. And oftentimes, we find ourselves saying, well, gosh, things were better in the old days. And they were. I'm convinced of it. But I think his point here is, if we're dwelling in the past, longing for the better days, we're not living in the present. And sometimes the best thing we can do is accept it. So when the exiles were in Babylon, what was God's message to them? Oh, just weep about Jerusalem, cry about Jerusalem, long to go back to Jerusalem, oh, long to go back to Jerusalem. No. Interestingly, here they were in exile, in Babylon, living as slaves, and here's what God's advice was to them. This is what, Jeremiah says, this is what the Lord Almighty, the God of Israel, says to those I carried into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and settle down. Plant gardens and eat what they produce. Marry and have sons and daughters. Find wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage so that they too may have sons and daughters. Increase in number there, do not decrease. Also, seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you in exile. Pray to the Lord for Babylon, because if it prospers, you too will prosper. In other words, settle in. Accept it. Now, if God could say that to people who had been devastated, their city leveled, and most of their population starved to death or were killed with a sword, and the rest were carried off as slaves to Babylon, and here they are in slavery, and God says, accept it. What might he be saying to you? What do you need to accept? The value of a good perspective. Sometimes we need to accept it. And then, maturely, with grace, live and flourish in today and not be focused on the past. And then verses 16 to 18. This speaks to me of the value of balance. And he says, do not be over-righteous. Neither be overwise. What? Again, he keeps turning conventional wisdom on his head. Isn't it good to be very wise? Isn't it good to be very righteous? In that context, think of the Pharisees, how overly righteous they were. As Jesus said, oh, they would strain a gnat and swallow a camel. Right? That's a good example of being overly righteous, overly wise. And he says, why destroy yourselves? Do not be overly wicked, and do not be a fool. Why die before your time? It's good to grasp the one and not let go of the other. The man who fears God will avoid all extremes. So it's kind of like Paul advising Timothy, the young pastor, drink some wine.
Oh, some of you teetotalers out there might be a little offended about this idea, but
that was the Apostle Paul giving advice to a young pastor, drink some wine. It'll help settle your upset stomach. You're having a lot of stomach problems, the wine will help. Don't be overly righteous, and don't be overly wise, but don't be, now, the worst would be to overly wicked and go that direction and overly foolish. Avoid extremes, though. So the warning here is against the extreme legalistic righteousness and excessive wisdom that makes me smarter than you. But also, what would be worse is extreme wickedness and foolishness. Avoid both legalism and libertinism. Libertinism? Yeah, that's somebody who's libertine. It's excessive, foolish, just jumping head deep, or, you know, jumping deep in to sin. Avoid these extremes. And then point eight, a possible offense. Ladies, you read verse 28 yet, chapter 7? Well, get ready. I found one upright man among a thousand, but not one upright woman among them all. Ooh, ouch, did that smart a little? Let me explain, okay? All right. Is King Solomon a misogynist? Ooh, another big word. You know that one, misogynist? It's not a massage therapist, okay? A misogynist? You're going to have to take this one back to school this weekend. You know, some guy that's like making belittling comments about girls. Just, are you a misogynist? Anyway, so just a misogynist is someone who belittles women, who has excessive prejudice against women, hates women, all right? Is that King Solomon? No. He was speaking in hyperbole here, hyperbole. So that's like Jesus when he says, if your hand calls you to sin, cut it off. If your eye calls you to sin, gouge it out. No, you're not actually going to do that. But he is, in order to illustrate his point, he goes to excess. And what he's just saying is, there's just, I mean, so much unrighteousness out there. In fact, earlier, if you would have looked, he says too, where was it? Verse 20, there is not a righteous man on earth who does what is right and never sins. Well, now he's saying there's one out of a thousand. No, for all have sinned and fallen short of God's glory. Okay, again, I want to erase from your minds, and feminists would have a heyday with this, and explain this is why the Bible then gives men credence for their misogyny. No. If you look at the whole scope, the whole counsel of Scriptures, and specifically some of the other things that King Solomon wrote from the Proverbs, what does he say in Proverbs 12:4? A wife of noble character, well, that's an upright woman, isn't it? She has noble character. A wife of noble character is her husband's crown. Yeah. And then he also says, he who finds a wife finds what is good and receives favor from the Lord. He's not a woman hater. And of course, then it was King Lemuel, not him, but it was the end of Proverbs. Proverbs 31, the Proverbs 31 woman, right? I mean, it raises up and exalts this most noble and righteous woman. It says, a wife of noble character is worth far more than rubies. Her children arise and call her blessed. Her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many women do noble things, but you surpass them all. No, no, we don't find this hatred towards women in the Bible. This was Solomon using hyperbole, going to an extreme to try and just say, you know what, out there it's hard to find an upright person. And it is, and it is. So, in conclusion, let me just give you some more advice and throw a challenge out there to you. These Proverbs, whether in Ecclesiastes or in the book of Proverbs, are phenomenal. And here's what they will do for you. If you will invest yourself in them, and if you will dedicate yourself to adding Proverbs to your daily devotional routine, and I encourage you to do that, whether it's a whole chapter a day of Proverbs, or whether it's just a few Proverbs a day, but let them wash over you. let them dig deep for those nuggets. It's like adding superfoods to your diet. You heard of the superfoods like blueberries or kale or whatever. Or like adding a supplement, fish oil or barley grass juice powder or something like that. It's like adding a fuel additive to your car, guys. It's going to supercharge your engine. And the wisdom that will develop in you, you can't even imagine. And King Solomon says throughout Proverbs, wisdom, you covet wisdom above all things, above gold, silver, jewels. Covet wisdom. It's so valuable. To grow in wisdom, add some Proverbs to your daily devotional chain. I want to encourage you to do that. And I hope that as I go through Ecclesiastes, that you're coming to find a great appreciation for this wisdom that we find there.